Hello again, this is Pastor Warren Hoyt. Today I want to look at the fourth chapter of Dr. J. Richards' great book, Money, Greed, and God. We've been going through this book chapter by chapter. By way of reminder, I want to let you know that the book deals with eight different myths that Dr. Richards says that even Christians have come to believe when it comes to capitalism. So far we've looked at three, and today we'll look at the fourth. The first myth is the Nirvana myth, which contrasts capitalism with an unrealizable ideal rather than with something real out there in the real world, the live alternatives. The second myth is called the piety myth. That's where we focus on our good intentions rather than on the unintended consequences of our actions. The third myth we looked at was the zero-sum game myth, which is believing that trade requires a winner and loser. Today we're going to look at the fourth chapter and the fourth myth, which Dr. Richards calls the materialist myth, which is believing that wealth isn't created, it's simply transferred. The chapter begins with a quote from Mark Stein. I love this guy. He's a Canadian writer. You often hear him on Rush Limbaugh or Fox News. Here's his quote. Worrying is the way the responsible citizen of an advanced society demonstrates his virtue. He feels good about feeling bad. Quote unquote. That's again Mark Stein, S-T-E-Y-N. Good quote. So a responsible citizen of an advanced society demonstrates his virtue by feeling good about feeling bad. And so Dr. Richards talks about in this chapter the fact that as American Christians, we're so rich in comparison with the rest of the world. Now, if everybody were poor, that would be real bad. But when some are poor and others are rich, it makes the rich feel guilty, as if they've somehow taken their riches, taken what they have from the poor. We must have more because we took it from the people who have less. You constantly hear this refrain, and you hear about how unjust it is that there are still poor people in America, the richest country in the world. Liberal Christian Jim Wallace said in a talk, quote, God hates inequality, unquote. Well, he gets a lot of applause and everything, and some people might think he's right, but really? God hates inequality? Winston Churchill said this, the inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. The inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of miseries. Most of us probably know that socialist solutions are worse than the disease they try to cure, but many still feel a nagging sense of unease because we have so much. Surely we're taking more than our fair share, right? So it's not just the knowledge that some are rich and others are poor. The real concern is that one causes the other. Latin American theologian Gustavo Gutierrez is mentioned in the book, and he actually says that Latin America is poor because North America is so rich. Christian writer Ron Sider says today's global markets appear to create unjust, dangerous extremes between rich and poor. So, quote, corrective action, unquote, is needed. Now, what does he have in mind there with this idea of corrective action? Obviously, he thinks governments should step in and redistribute the wealth, right? The problem is that so many of us have a wrong understanding of how the economy works. People imagine the wealth of the world like a big cherry pie. If you have this pie and you cut big fat slices for a couple people, well, that means that everybody else is going to get slimmer slices if they get anything at all, right? Again, it's the idea of the zero-sum game. But as we saw in the last chapter, it's just not accurate. The truth is this pie of wealth in the world and of the economy has been getting bigger and bigger every year for hundreds of years because wealth is produced. It's not just moved from one owner to another. On pages 87 to 89, Richards has some interesting facts. I'm going to quote a few of them to you. He talks there about how the average poor person in America has it better than the majority of the world has ever had it. So there are many people in America who are considered poor by our standards, but yet they end up having it way better than the majority of the world has has it now or has ever had it in history. For example, 46% of all poor households actually own their homes, a three-bedroom, one-and-a-half home with a garage, porch, and patio. 76% of poor households have air conditioning, whereas 30 years ago, only 36% of all Americans had air conditioning. Only 6% of poor households are overcrowded. More than two-thirds have more than two rooms per person. The average poor American has more living space than the average person in Paris, London, Vienna, Athens, or any of several other European cities. So these are the average citizens of those countries compared with the poor citizens of our country. And he goes on, you know, how many of our people who qualify as poor have a car or even two cars or a color TV or two or more color TVs and a microwave oven, stereo, and so on and so forth. So the point is, these folks are called the poor in America, and they're poorer than most Americans. But it's a relative poverty, not an absolute poverty. They're relatively poor compared to others, but they're not absolutely poor. Absolute poverty is when you don't have enough to eat or a place to get out of the rain or the cold. And so then Richards lists some other statistics. You know, one-third of deaths, about 18 million people a year or 50,000 a day, are due to poverty-related causes. Roughly the population of the U.S. has died since 1990 due to that kind of cause. Every year, more than 10 million children die of hunger and preventable diseases. That's over 30,000 a day, one every 3 seconds. Over a billion people on Earth live on less than a dollar a day, and some 2.8 billion live on less than $2 a day. 600 million children live in absolute poverty. The three richest people in the world control more wealth than all 600 million people living in the world's poorest countries. And so these are some really sad statistics that delineate what absolute poverty is. And they highlight the tremendous gap that exists between rich and poor. This sounds terrible, and any decent person, of course, would wish that they could somehow alleviate the suffering of these poor people. But one item on this list that Richards has here is, as the Sesame Street jingle used to say, not like the others. And it's the point where he says the three richest people in the world control more wealth than all 600 million people living in the world's poorest countries. This isn't just a fact, it's a comparison. And the idea is, it conveys that somehow those three guys are rich because the others are poor. Or at least it conveys the idea that, hey, these rich guys, they should take care of these poor people, right? Richard says, complaints about gaps almost always reflect a basic confusion about the nature of wealth. When we hear that the gap has grown, we're supposed to think the fact that the rich are getting richer is what makes the poor get poorer. But that would only be true if the total amount of wealth were static, which isn't the case. The economy isn't a zero-sum game. Remember? That's what we looked at Chapter 3. And so Jay Richards has this good illustration of an imaginary country called Atlantis that has 1,000 citizens. And he's just illustrating the point here about this gap between rich and poor and how you really need to look at it from a different perspective. Say there's this country called Atlantis with 1,000 citizens. 10 years ago, 999 Atlanteans had incomes of $1,000 a year. And one fat cat Atlantean, he made $1 million a year, which is 1,000 times what everybody else made, right? Well, what if we heard that in the last 10 years, the income gap had grown tenfold? Well, that sounds terrible, right? But that's only if we assume it's because the fat cat got richer at everyone else's expense. Without any further info, it'd sound really bad for the people. But what if you found out that they all now make $10,000 a year while the rich guy makes $100 million? Look at that. That changes everything, doesn't it? The gap has grown tenfold. Yeah, it's true. But the 999 people are making 10 times more than they were 10 years ago. They're actually better off. They just have a smaller percentage of a much bigger pie. See, we need this kind of a perspective to understand how this stuff works. Saying the three richest men control, quote unquote, more than the 600 million poorest people sounds really bad. But it's a biased way of even saying it when you say they control the wealth. What if you said they've created more wealth than the 600 million poorest people? That doesn't sound as bad, does it? It frames the problem in different terms. The concern then becomes not why these guys have so much more than the others, but how come these others have been able to create so little? That changes the whole nature of our thinking. And so the relevant issue isn't whether any kind of gap has grown. The issue is whether or not the situation of poor people is improving at all. Listen to this. From 1947 to 2005, the average income of the richest 20% of the U.S. population went up almost every year. It went up from $8,072 in 1947 to $184,500 in 2005. That's adjusted for inflation. But guess what? This didn't come at the expense of the poor. On the contrary, the real incomes of the poorest 20% of Americans also went up every year from $1,584 in 1947 to $25,616 in 2005. All of this happened while the population doubled. So look at that. What it's telling us is the total amount of wealth went up. The rich didn't get rich by making the poor poorer at all. Everybody got richer. The pie got bigger. And some of the poor actually moved up the ladder to other classes. They're not poor anymore. Upward mobility is a real possibility in our system. By the way, Jay Richards points out, you can go to gapminder.org, GAPMINDER.org, and they have this cool graphic there that shows you how different societies, different nations of the world are moving up the ladder wherever there's freedom and democracy and the possibility of creating wealth. It's an interesting graphic. You click play and it moves right in front of your eyes. The only countries that buck the trend are these countries where the government controls the economy or where there's dictatorships, where the basic foundation for prosperity doesn't exist. And so Richard says, comparing countries, there is one unmistakable trend. Countries with the rule of law and economic freedom prosper over time. Countries without these virtues do not, end quote. So the point is, again, the total amount of wealth increases over time. Why? Because wealth is not just a material thing, but spiritual. Now that takes a little thinking. You might say, what do you mean wealth is spiritual? Well, wealth comes about through creativity, initiative, beliefs, things like that, that are immaterial. So Richard says wealth, he says, here's a quote, wealth isn't about stuff, it's about us, unquote. And he goes on to say, at the heart of economics then is a reality that exists not in material objects, but in our individual and collective minds, unquote. So even money itself, you know, isn't a material reality because money is just paper. It only has worth because we have faith in its worth, and many people believe in it, so it's a useful thing to use for trade, but it's not really valuable in itself. Its value is immaterial. So again, the materialist myth is what we're talking about here in chapter 4, the idea that wealth isn't created but simply transferred. So to disprove this, Richards has shown these things we just looked at, but he also spends pages showing how wealth has been created over human history. In the beginning, all humans were subsistence farmers. They could only, you know, scratch out an existence out of the dirt, now having sheep and goats and so forth. Over centuries of time, though, we learned new techniques. We developed new tools and technologies, and they've allowed us to create all sorts of things, from plowshares to axes to fertilizer to tractors to money, credit, trade, banks, all of that. All of these developments have enabled us to expand wealth astronomically. So there's much more available now than there ever was before. Today we can create more and more wealth from less and less matter. As an example, a fiber optic cable made of 60 pounds of cheap sand, you know, silica sand, now carries thousands of times more information than a 2,000-pound cable made of much more expensive copper. Think about it. See, and that's just, we're using a cheaper ingredient, sand, but we're achieving far greater results with it. And that's just the way it goes with everything. Think about food production. That's another clear example. It used to be everybody was a farmer. Now only 1.9% of the American population farms. And yet, that 1.9% produces so much food that they not only feed all of us here in America, but they have plenty to sell and export besides. This is a funny thing. Around the very end of the 19th century, Charles H. Duell, commissioner of the U.S. Patent Office, announced that, quote, "everything that can be invented has been invented," unquote. Can you imagine that? He thought that at the end of the 19th century. Around 1870, there were some 15,000 patents granted every year. But now, guess what? The average total exceeds 150,000 a year. Think of the developments we see and hear in the high-tech industry, for example. Computers, every 2-3 years, you got to get rid of them and buy a new one because the computing capacity is just growing exponentially. It's expanding beyond anything we could have imagined. So all of this is an example of how wealth is increasing. And given this history, there's no reason to think that wealth would not continue to increase in unlimited fashion. The only thing that can hinder wealth from growing is the kind of stuff we mentioned already. Dictatorships, repression, chaos, war, lack of human rights, imposition of socialism, that kind of thing is what has been shown to thwart prosperity. I'm reading this book by Dr. Rodney Stark about the beginning of capitalism and so on, and he talks about how Spain is really an example. Spain, when they explored the New World after Columbus and all, they began to bring back so much gold and silver from the New World, you know, that they became very rich. But it's interesting, Spain did not last in that prosperity. Instead, their wealth diminished in a very few short years. And Dr. Rodney Stark shows that the reason is because of their bad policies. So it's not capitalism is not bad. What happens is bad policies can thwart capitalism. Now, why do Americans believe in equality? Thomas Jefferson said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." But really, self-evident? It's not so self-evident if you think about it. We're tall, short, fat, skinny, black, white, athletic, uncoordinated. Who said we're created equal? Obviously, Jefferson didn't mean physically. He just meant that one God created us, so we all have rights. But we all tend to link inequality of outcome or opportunity with injustice. Yet they're not the same thing. God doesn't make everything equal for everybody. Listen to this quote. "If God can be just without sharing his blessings equally, might the same be true for society?" Unquote. Of course. Hello. It's dry in El Paso. It's wet in Florida. They're not equal. Some states have mountains. Others are flat. They're just, some places are hot. Others are cold. God doesn't create equality. Some, even Christians, think it's wrong and dangerous for wealth to be concentrated in the hands of a minority, you know, the 1%, the 20%, or whatever. So what can be done about that? Well, the government could regulate wealth. The government could redistribute it by force. But first of all, that would be unjust. You're ripping people off for their just fruits of their efforts. You're just taking them from them. Second, it would create tremendous havoc and destroy the economy. And Jay Richards says this, which I thought was chistoso, a little bit humorous. "There are lots of things governments can't do," he says, "but it's been proven over and over that they can very definitely create poverty really well." Governments can create poverty. Lots of left-leaning people think the answer is to redistribute the wealth by taxing the rich disproportionately, taking their wealth from them and giving them to the poor. That way we'll make things all balanced and and equal. Well, that's usually not a very wise way to go. The truth is, though, the top 1% already pay almost all the taxes. Do people realize that? People of lower incomes don't pay the taxes. It's the rich people who do. But not only is that true, think about this. What group or organization would be invested with the power to take money from the populace and redistribute it? Hello. I guess you want the government to do that, right? So you're worried about a minority, the rich people, having too much power, but you want to give more power to the government? You think that minority is more just? You think the U.S. government is better able to handle and direct what's done with the majority's power and wealth? Hey, That's scary. That's a scary idea. That's why some people have said democracies can't exist long. Because as soon as the voters realize they can vote to put people into office who will give them more, and as soon as the politicians realize they can get elected by promising more, the whole system will begin to collapse. And buddy, let me tell you, that's exactly what's happening in America today. Loose fiscal policy is usually what brings democracies down. How long can a society exist once a majority discovers it can vote to have the state confiscate the wealth of a minority and give it to them? Wow, this is what we have people trying to do today in our country. That's why this book is so important, Money, Greed, and God by Dr. Jay Richards. He's got a quote here from Bill Gates. He told them, the Harvard graduating class of 2007, that economic inequality was a moral outrage and that reducing inequality is the highest human achievement. And he says Jim Wallace has also complained that the greatest crisis of American democracy today is the division of wealth. This is what Richard says about it. Nonsense. Nonsense. Listen, if this were true, what these guys are saying, we should all be furious and up in arms at Bill Gates because he has more than we do. But it's not true. This sort of hand-wringing and complaining is ungodly, and it doesn't address or solve the real problems. What it does is it stirs up discontent and it focuses attention on the wrong issue entirely. In the kingdom of God, there will still be inequality, but there won't be poverty. Hello. I'm going to end this section today with a final quote from Dr. Richards. Until a few centuries ago, most Europeans were as dirt poor as many in the third world today. Historically, our current pockets of prosperity are highly unusual. We rightly see poverty as a problem, just as disease is a problem. But the problem isn't that some people are rich and some are poor, any more than the problem of disease is that some people are healthy. The problem is quite simply that some are poor. If we want to bask in the wasteful heat of self-righteous moral indignation, then by all means, let's keep blathering on about income gaps. But if we really want to help the poor, we need to get our eyes off decoys and focus on the real problem, poverty, and its only known solution, which is creating wealth. You see why I like this book? These are important truths that we need to get hold of and spread out to the society in which we live, because many today are confused and misguided when it comes to these issues. That'll be all for today, but I hope you'll join me next time as we look at Chapter 5 and the next myth that so many are believing today. Until that time, may the Lord bless you.